Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to Stop Hammer Time. My name's Phil Whelans and it's a special Stop Hammer Time we've got this week. With me is a radio producer, podcast producer, journalist. It's Mark Sandell.
Good day to you.
Hello, Mark.
Good day to you, Phil.
Everything all right?
Yes, not bad at all.
And what makes this a special podcast is that we have with us a guest that we had 9 years ago when we did live podcasts, and it was always a thrill to do them with players. And when we had this player, we thought we have to do this as a podcast, and a large bunch of people packed into a room above a pub in London as we talked to Julian Dix. Julian, great to see you.
Thank you very much. How are you?
Really well. Yeah, that was a really good night, that podcast. Cass Pennant came to that podcast.
Yeah, I remember. It was good.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. Now, you have a book out. It's going to come out next week, the 8th, the day after the Europa Conference final. Julian Dix, Hammer Time, Me, West Ham, and a Passion for the Shirt. I got a PDF of the book last night. I've dipped into a few chunks from it, trying to get a feel for it. And it's really great, Julian. It's really great. You know what? It's like, I think what we want from these books is like a sense of what it's like to be a footballer. You know, as fans, we're all going, what do they do all week in training? And, you know, what is it like being a footballer? And, you know, quite a lot of footballers, they've got anecdotes. They've got anecdotes they kind of trot out, but you don't necessarily know what it's like being a footballer day to day. And this book's great. There's just, it jumps back and forward in time a lot, which I really like. There are things that happen at West Ham that set off a kind of memory of something that happened at Birmingham. So you just jump right back in time and talk about something that happened in Birmingham. So we get into you having to leave home in Bristol at 14 and go to Birmingham, just how weird that is, and that you go home at the weekends, you play for your new school in Birmingham. You know, this is all the stuff we really want to know. It's great. What did you sort of set out to do when you did this book? Did you look at any other biographies?
No, not really. It was just a case of basically telling my story. Like I said, I left home when I was 14.
Yeah.
And I went to school in Washwood Heath. I hated school with a passion. Yeah. I hated school. But it gave me a chance to get away from Bristol, which I wasn't being a very nice boy in Bristol, getting in trouble and stuff like that. So I went to Birmingham, lived in digs in Birmingham with young pros and apprentices. I was only 14 at the time, so obviously I was still going to school. And I would play Saturday morning for my school side. I would jump on the train. I'd go and play Saturday afternoon for my Saturday side in Bristol. I would play Sunday morning, and I would play Sunday afternoon. Then I would jump on the train again and go back to Birmingham and obviously go to school for the week. Sometimes I would go training after school at Birmingham City with the youth teams at the time and stuff like that. So it was when I was homesick. Don't get me wrong, I was 14. Yeah. First time I've been away from home, I was homesick, but it's something I wanted to do. So It was good. It was a good upbringing for me.
Yeah. You know, like just one sentence in the book is, you know, really incredibly sort of profound and says a lot about the sport, because you sort of say basically just me and Ian Taylor from an intake of Birmingham youth players went on to have, you know, decent, successful professional football careers. That's two guys out of an intake of kids. It's a, you know, that filter that's going on for kids those age, they're being filtered and filtered and filtered and filtered, so that, you know, you can basically look at two guys that came out of that whole intake. That's really interesting. Do you think that, I mean, what do you think a young player kind of shows to the to coaches and people that are trying to develop football talent? What do you think might have been seen in you? What do you see in young players? What, you know, is it just that they're just miles better than everyone else? Or,
well, yes, sometimes obviously a kid stands out head and shoulders above everybody else, but that don't mean he's going to make a footballer. Mine was a bit different. As I said, I left home when I was 14. My manager at the time was Ron Saunders. I was guaranteed apprenticeship. I was guaranteed pro. But again, that still don't mean that you're going to make it as a footballer. It's one of them. Back then, it was about working hard. Like I said, when I was 16, I signed my apprenticeship forms. I was training with people like Tony Coughlan, Mark Dennis, Pat Vandenau, Noel Blake, Mick Hartford, Robert Hopkins, Martin Cole. And they will kick the shit out of you.
Yeah.
They would give you an upbringing like you've never had before. So it was great from that point of view. So I had to look after myself basically from day one. Like I said, moving home was tough. But going training with them players was even tougher. So again, it's, you could have all the ability in the world. If you haven't got a work rate, you're not going to make it. But again, it's when my dad was a semi-pro footballer in Bristol. It was a case of like, you have to, every game, you have to give 100%. Every game.
Yeah.
Regardless of what's going on in your private life or anything like that. Every game, you have to give 100%. We all have bad games. We all make mistakes. That's a part of football. That's a part of life. But there's no excuses for not giving 100%. And that's basically every game I played. I can truly put my hand on my heart and go, that's what I've done.
Yeah. It's funny that there's two things that pull in two different directions, because there's obviously incredibly hard work on the pitch. But you are, if nothing not, known for your... For your pre-game regime of a couple of Mars bars and a couple of bottles of Coke, which probably wouldn't stand the test of time in most fitness clubs. Have fitness coaches, diet coaches now, don't they? There's actual diet coaches at clubs now, aren't there?
There is, yeah. Like I said, they eat properly and everything else. But again, back then it was a different era, and I would sit in my bath. I'd sit in my bath with just my football boots on, with two cans of Coke and a Mars bar. And I could, obviously, all the boys would go out and do their warm-ups and things like that. So, but I was lucky that I could just go out and just start smashing balls about. I was lucky that I could do that. And we had a player called Timmy Breaker, who was a right-back. Timmy used to do a warm-up for a warm-up. You know what I mean? Timmy would be warming up for an hour. But if he had just went out and started smashing balls about, he would have pulled up. And I remember Harry was saying to me, look, June, you've got to start stretching now. I was like 24, 25 years old. You've got to start stretching. You've got to do this. I went, hey, I'm not stretching. I said, I know I will pull something if I stretch. He went, no, you've got to stretch. So one day we were in training, right? Everybody's got to stretch. So I started stretching. And then I kicked a ball and I pulled my hamstring. But it was a moody hamstring. I didn't pull it just so I could say to Harry, look what you made me done. So I didn't train for two or three days, and he never made me warm up again. So I got my way with that one.
Julian, you've seen obviously both sides of it as a player and as a coach. And you said about your past in Bristol, and you weren't, as you say, always, it's a bit of a checkered past and all that kind of thing.
Yes.
You as a coach, how would you deal with a player like you?
It depends how good he was. Now, we're talking about players now that, and we had a player called like Dimi Payet at West Ham. Dimi was a magnificent player. Don't get me wrong, worked hard at training and everything else. Didn't always track back or anything like that. But when he got the ball, he made things happen. You know what I mean? He scored goals. He assisted. That's for me, it's the same with me. At the end of the day, I wasn't the best trainer in the world when we had to come to run in and things like that. But managers let me not get away with many things, but they knew what they were going to get. I mean, I scored plenty, from a left-back point of view, I scored plenty of goals. I assisted plenty of goals. So for me, I could every game something would happen. Maybe I got sent off or whatnot. But I would score goals and I would assist. So I made things happen from my point of view. If it was just a case of I scored a goal every 8 weeks or I had one assist every 8 weeks, that's not enough. So you have to give and take in relationships. And that's what football is with a manager and a player.
So cutting you a lot of slack, would you say? Cutting you a lot of slack because you delivered on the pitch?
Yeah, because I had to deliver on the pitch, And otherwise, they wouldn't have, like, especially Billy Bonds and John Bond and Ron Salt, they wouldn't have allowed that. They would never have allowed that. So that is very true, yeah.
Yeah, I wonder whether that is a sort of, you know, what we were talking about earlier, what you might see in a young player that makes you think, well, this guy's going to make the grade. Is that making something happen? You know, one thing I always talk about when I talk about you, my favourite West Ham left back, was that you changed a game from the left back position. You know, if we went a couple of goals down, it was as if you went, I'm not having this, and you, next time you picked up the ball, just started a run just to see how far you could get, which was quite often to the byline and put a cross in, or sometimes to put a shot. And seeing a player, you know, we've had players, I won't say too many names, but you know, like the you feel they keep their head down, they do their bit of the job, and that's it. They seem very sort of coached. Yeah. Marko Arnautović was someone who wanted to make the life of the centre-back he's facing up or the full-back he's facing. He wanted to make their life difficult. He wanted to make something happen. That's what I liked about him. Di Canio, obviously. You, from the left-back position, would influence how a game made. And I think that is something you must kind of... That's got to be just an instinct. You almost can't teach that. That's just a sort of...
Yeah, I remember when Ludo come in, I said, because Ludo's English wasn't very good in the beginning. And I remember saying to Ludo, I said, Ludo, every time you get the ball, fucking throw it to me. Every time. Just throw me the ball. Not like, because back then, your wingers didn't stay up top. They went back. So every time I got the ball, Ludo will throw me the ball. Yeah, and I had probably 20, 30 yards in front of me. But what players do now, their first option is they go inside. My first option is, get the ball out of my feet, run with that ball.
Because they have
to come and close you down. And if they don't close you down, you just keep running. And when they do close you down, they obviously have to leave a player so you can play balls into people. But it was a case of, Ludo, just give me the ball. I'm going to get it. I'm going to run as far as I can. Plus, I had a good left foot on me, so I could pick players. Yeah. People like Leroy or Ian Dowie or John Hartson or McAvenny or TC. I could pick them players out. So it was a case of, I could start an attack from defence.
I've got a very vivid memory of you and a goalkeeper. Was like it was quite difficult to either get your head or chest on it to get it back to Xhaka so that he could pick it up. But Xhaka sort of went to trap it with his foot and kick it, and you just went, pick it up! Because I think you just didn't trust him on the deck.
No, back then, the goalies like Phil Parks, obviously Xhaka and Ludo, they weren't great with their feet. Not like the keepers nowadays.
Yeah, it was really funny. You could hear it. It was louder than the noise of the crowd. You going? But another great thing about the book is that what you see about a sportsman is like, you know, there are things that you on the whole are trying to do things you want to do. You don't want to do anything you don't want to do. But those times that things that are kind of, it's sort of a bit out of your hands, you have to do it. So obviously things like Julian meet me in the office afterwards. You think you're in trouble, but they go, you know, West Ham United's come in with an offer for you, and we're going to take it. Similarly, you know, Liverpool coming in with things that are out of your hands, but also just the things that you have to do. Like there's a bit where you bemoan having to go and hand the team sheet to the ref before the game, and just it's like a ball ache. And that's another great thing about the book, which, as I say to everyone, is out next Wednesday. Go and get it. It looks fucking great. But it is like that set sort of sense of like things that you can control mixed with things you can't control. Like, you know, it's a nice little bit when you talk about going to Canvey Island afterwards, you know, that just little short spell at Canvey Island, you really, really enjoyed it. And it was something you wanted to do. It happened. And it was like an all round really good experience by the sound of it for you.
Yeah, I obviously retired at West Ham when I was 29, and all I've ever wanted to do is play football. It's all I've ever wanted to do, whether that's for West Ham, for Birmingham, non-league, I just want to play football. And I had, I think, about 6-7 months out the game, and I remember saying to my agent at the time, Rachel, my knee feels better. I'd like, not great, but it feels better. I just want to play football. So she knew Jeff King at Canvey. And I went to Canvey. And it was, I enjoyed it. We only trained twice a week, but we had a good side. And it was fantastic. You know what I mean? And you're playing against players that in non-leagues, obviously not as good as players that you're playing with in the Premiership or things like that. But the opposing players, because it was me, were trying to fucking kick me and everything else, which I thought was fantastic. So it was a case of blood, thunder, guts. It was like a different game because you were just kicking proper shit out of each other. And I really, really enjoyed it. But unfortunately, it was only lasted 12 games because of like my knee swelled up again and things like that. So, but yeah, that was, if I could still play football now, I would, because I miss playing for West Ham at Upton Park every day. I think about it every single day.
Right.
And if I could still play now, I would.
Yeah.
But
absolutely.
Unfortunately, I struggle to walk now, let alone play football.
Julian, you've always said that all you ever wanted to do was play football, and as you say, you still miss it now, that business of playing and everything. But famously, you've always said you don't particularly like watching football. Is that still the case?
No. Yeah, it's still the case. I get frustrated, especially as the game goes on. I don't mean through the 90 minutes, but you got people trying to get people sent off and yellow cards and the manager's trying to get opposing players sent off. There's no room for that in football. It's wrong. It's wrong on all levels. And it frustrates me. It frustrates me that people who are not really injured lie on the floor and they roll over and they roll over and they roll over. I think the only person that ever done that was Paul Gascoigne, and he was taking the piss when he got kicked and he rolled over. He rolled over about 20 times. But the players now, they do it on a regular basis. And for me, it's not right. And I just find it all frustrating. Don't get me wrong, I've never been a lover of watching football because all I want to do is play. And if there is a bit on the telly, my missus keeps saying to me, keep your legs still. So I'm kicking every ball, but it does frustrate me. It does.
Since you mentioned Paul Gascoigne, Julian. You roomed with him, didn't you? How did that work out?
Well, it didn't work out very good. We were travelling with the under-21s. We were playing in Toulon in France in a tournament. And I remember Dave Sexton was the manager. And for some reason, he says, who wants to share with Paul Gascoigne? And no one put their hands up. And I'm thinking, it's the first time I've been with them, and I'm thinking, ah, fuck it, I'll share with them. So I put my hand up. Fucking wrong decision. wrong decision. He don't sleep. He's obviously he's hyper. But he's such a nice bloke. Honestly, he was great fun to be with. But he's a really, really, really nice bloke. But he was just nuts. Like things he would do, like flicking toothpaste at people out the window and stuff. Like I go, what are you doing? I said they look at. I mean, Paul was known not worldwide then, but he was known, and they go, oh yeah, Paul Gascoigne. They flicking toothpaste at people walking by. Yeah. And like I said, with the toilet seat, he put firecrackers on the toilet seat and set them all off. But he finds that funny. I mean, I find it funny now. At the time, yeah. I didn't. You know what I mean? He was crazy, but he was such a nice bloke.
Yeah, that's funny. So, your sort of management and assistant coach and assistant management first team coach sort of experience is now really sort of far and wide, right from West Ham United down to Heybridge Swift, Wivenhoe. When you made a move into management, was it totally unlike anything you imagined it was going to be, or did you pretty much know what it was going to be? You've played under, obviously, Saunders Bond, Lyle McCarrey, Bonds, Redknapp, lots of managers, Souness, Evans. Yeah. So you've seen a lot of managers at work. So when you started doing it to yourself, were you surprised by, was it harder than you thought? Was it easier than you thought?
Well, I was never going into management or coaching, to be honest, after, because I retired when I was 29. I was quite bitter, to be honest. Retiring, but my friends like lives in Wivenhoe, and the team was struggling, and they didn't have a manager. He said, "Can you come and manage Wivenhoe? They're going to go down." So I went in there, and I think there was about 12 games to go, and he said, "Like we've got to win, I don't know, 5 or 6 in whatever to stay up." So, but I kept him up. With 3 games to go, which was obviously was good. Did I enjoy it? Yeah, it was okay. Don't get me wrong. I wouldn't turn around and go, yeah, I thoroughly enjoyed it. It was okay. But it's one of them. You treat people how you want to be treated.
Yeah.
Listen, don't get me wrong. I got loads of bollockings when I played, and I got sandwiches thrown at me and pots of tea and everything else. But at the end of the day, these players, they have to go to work. They go to work. Then they come and train because they want to. And then we play on a Saturday. And I did enjoy it. I hate losing. Yeah, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I hate losing. I had to take – when we got beat, I couldn't go in the dressing room for probably 5 minutes because my head was boiling. But – That Wivenhoe, we kept them up. That finished. So then I went to Grays. Grays again. I enjoyed it as such. But obviously the pro level is obviously a lot different. Obviously training's all structured. You train every day and I do enjoy it. I'm not going to sit here and say I don't enjoy it. I do enjoy it, but I still find it frustrating.
Did you, when you were a manager, did it make you think about how you behave towards managers? Because, you know.
No, not at all.
Right, because Bonzo said, didn't Billy Bonzo once say he wanted to chin you, and Harry Redknapp talked about, did it make you think, blimey, this is, you know, I'm glad I haven't got a dressing room full of Julian Dix.
No, not at all, because if I did, we'd win the league. No. I mean, you're always going to have a player that's different from other people. You know what I mean? But like I said to you before, as long as when he plays, he makes things happen. I have no, because you have to give and take. Not everybody's whiter than white. There is some fucking bad eggs in things like, yeah, I have rows with majority of my managers, but they all played me. They all played me in game for a reason, because they knew what they would get. I mean, Billy Barnes probably had the worst of me, because Billy was the fittest player I've ever known, and he was 42 years old at the time. And when he became manager of West Ham, I think he was about 45, 46, and he was still the fittest person, because he used to love running. I hated fucking running. But because Billy was manager, that's what we done a lot in training, was running. And we used to do a mile round the pitch, which is about 5.5 times. And you get people like Martin Allen, Matthew Rush, doing it in about 5 minutes and stuff. I took 13 minutes to do mine. So obviously Billy wasn't very happy. But I said, Bill, I said, let the players play, let the runners run. So it was a case of I had to make sure that when I played, that I did make things happen.
You said that your manager...
Yeah, that was in my head, because... Sorry,
I was going to say, you said that your managers always knew what they were going to get. And one of the things they always knew they were going to get was one of the greatest penalty takers I've ever had the privilege of seeing. And I think a lot of West Ham fans' memories are tied up in your brilliant penalty taking. I wonder what you make, when you do occasionally watch football, of the style of penalty taking you see now. There's so many more penalty shootouts, the little hop, skip and a jump and the no looks and all that kind of thing. Would your technique ever have changed?
No, well, it did change, because I remember we played Watford in a cup game, and it went to penalties, and it was my penalty, and I placed it, and I hit the post, and I said to myself, then I'm never ever going to place a penalty again. I'm going to hit it as hard as I can, because for me, a professional footballer should never miss the target from 12 yards. No. Okay, you can hit the post, you can hit the crossbar, whatever, you can hit the goalkeeper, but you should never miss a target. So I said to myself, if I hit it as hard as I can on target, 9 times out of 10, I'm going to score. Because if I don't know where it's going, then the goalkeeper's got no chance to know where it's going. And that was it. From that day, I just hit them as hard as I could.
Yeah, yeah. And also, it's you hit them so hard that even if the goalkeeper guesses right, he can't move his hand through the air in time to get it on the ball. Like, you know, that one against Manchester United where you whack it in twice. Schmeichel's like not far off it. He's kind of in the right direction. He just literally cannot move his arm through the air in time to get it. And that's like the, you know, that's the thing about whacking it hard. You know, Noble's technique was he would whack it, you know.
Yeah.
And
Ray Stewart, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, Stewart's penalties were great as well.
Yeah.
So those ones are odd, those kind of just gently placed ones.
But the thing is, you've got like the best players in the world missing the target. Like Messi misses a target.
Yeah.
Ronaldo misses a target. For me, that should never happen. Should never happen.
No, penalty is supposed to penalise the other team. That's why it's called a penalty. You should stick that away. That one of those, the Euros or the World Cup, somewhere around 2004, where like Lampard misses his, Gerrard misses his, everyone misses, except the bloke who plays in Germany. I mean, Hargreaves, I think, stuck his in. It was disastrous. We missed nearly everyone. And you're like, come on, lads, you're pro footballers. You've got to bang one of these away.
Yeah, but the thing is, you have to have confidence to take a penalty. Now, I go back to Paul Ince. I mean, Paul Ince was so full of confidence in himself, bordering on arrogant, but he would never take a penalty because he was scared to take a penalty.
Yes.
So you have to be not a certain person, but you have to be confident that you're going to step up and you're going to score. Not one of my penalties I thought I would ever miss. Like you say, you do, and it does happen, but you should never miss a target.
No, when you put the ball on the spot, you just thought, well, this is a goal. It was fantastic. You know, obviously you were on the coaching staff with Slav. At the time, we had a fantastic season with a high finish, Dimitri Payet, and then things started to sort of go wrong. Do you have a sort of perspective on what sort of went wrong in that period at all, from a coaching point of view or just from the player point of view?
I mean, listen, a West Ham fan. At the end of the day, ever since I've been there, they've been a yo-yo club.
Yeah.
And it seems like even though they haven't changed.
Absolutely.
But we did have a great season. And for like, obviously what happened with Dimi, I mean, Dimi was a, listen, whatever people think about him, he was a magnificent footballer. He was a good trainer. He worked hard. And what happened with when he didn't play, we missed him massively. No, I mean, massively. But he was one of them players that, like I said earlier about, he didn't always track back, but you knew what you were going to get from him going forward. He was one of them players that we missed massively, massively, massively. And I can't state that big enough. But then obviously we changed grounds in everything else. And we've gone from, for me, one of the most iconic grounds in the world. I mean, I love Upton Park, and for me, it's the best place in the world to play football. To a stadium that's, you could put four Upton Parks in. But I think the first four games we had to play away from home.
That's right. Yeah, yeah.
Which never helps any side. I don't care if you're Man City, it doesn't help any side. So things didn't get off great from that point of view. But Dimi was a big issue because he was such a good player.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Now, Julian, I know we've only got you for half an hour, so we better sort of wrap up. But I do want to say that the book, Julian Dix, Hammer Time, Me, West Ham, and a Passion for the Shirt, as I say, I just got a PDF last night, and I read like a couple of big chunks last night and dipped into some other bits this morning, and I absolutely will voraciously devour the rest. It's really good. It's really good. You know, like, I haven't read a lot of sports biographies. The Andre Agassi one is like one of the best sort of sports biographies I've ever read. But what they do is give you kind of an insight into what this job that only a tiny percentage of the population could do, like 0.00%, but loads of us go and watch what it's like to do that job. It's great. It's great. The structure's great. The way it flashes back and forwards from time at Birmingham right up to Upton Park, the different sort of chapter headings, like the characters you met, all that stuff is really great. It's a great piece of work, Julian. So congratulations on that. And it's out next week.
And in a word, Julian, are we going to win in Prague?
Well, so obviously I've been speaking to West Ham fans and everything else. And for me, this is a cup final. It is a cup final. Whether it's a conference, doesn't matter. It is a cup final. And it ain't been a great season for West Ham in the league. But it gives something else to the West Ham fans. It is a cup final. And for me, again, my head and my heart, I think West Ham are too strong for them. But that also means that they have to go out and they have to dictate. You can't sit back against teams like Florentino that you think, oh, yeah, we sit back and we're not on the counter-attack, we're taking. Ain't going to happen like that. It's one game. No. You have to go out, you have to give. Every player has to give 100%. Whether you play well or not, listen, that depends on the day because, like I said, we all have bad games, we all make mistakes. But for me, I think West Ham would be too strong from if they go out and play how they should play, which is correct. When you get the ball, attack them, put them under pressure, because we have some good players.
Well, if it goes to penalties, you know, we'll miss you then, Julian.
We will. This has been Stop Hammer Time. My name's Phil Whelans. With me have been Mark Sandell.
Good afternoon.
And Julian Dix.
Thank you very much.
Come on, you Irons. Sports Social Podcast Network.